Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Heidi Perryman. She's a child psychologist who became an accidental beaver advocate when a pair moved into Martinez, California. The city was concerned that their beaver dam would cause flooding and recommended trapping. She formed the group Worth a Dam to find solutions and educate the community about the benefits of urban beavers. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Well, thank you so much for asking me to be here. I'd love to talk about our beavers and what our city did to kind of cooperate with them.
Well, that's great. So can we do an introduction to beavers in general and then transition from beavers in general to urban beavers in specific?
Right. Okay. Well, beavers are aquatic mammals. They are native to North America, and they are a species that has developed a habit of being able to build ponds for their survival. It kind of increases their access to food, and it increases their safety. But because they build these ponds, they actually end up benefiting all other different kinds of species. So there are more fish, there are more insects, there are more birds, there are more amphibians surrounding a beaver pond. And that really is a very instrumental part of what why beavers matter on the landscape.
And weren't there almost unbelievable numbers of beavers in many parts of North America prior to conquest?
Yes. From the top of Canada down to the top of Mexico, there were beavers in every stream, river, and rill, supposedly. Every pond had beavers in it, every creek. And they really were busily shaping our landscape for millions of years, and they actually created this rich arable farmland that all of America relies on now. But they did that as a function of making their ponds to keep themselves safe and ending up benefiting all these other creatures.
So before we talk about the Martinez beavers and urban beavers, can you talk a little bit about, who eats beavers in the wild? have to protect themselves from whom?
Yeah, well, obviously, the wild used to be a really different place than it is now. So, right, we don't have wolves in California much to speak of, so we're not worried about wolves in California or Martinez. But beavers are eaten by bears, they're eaten by coyotes, they're eaten by bobcats. Young beavers are predated by otter. So actually, beavers are an easy meal, especially if they're found on land. And that really is a piece of how they contribute to the ecosystem as well. In urban settings, there aren't as many predators, obviously, but we also have beavers that die from natural causes, or beavers that die from, you know, a couple of our beavers died from roundworm parasite, which they probably caught from a raccoon. So it is normal for the population to also suffer some losses.
Before we move on, can you talk a little bit about lifestyle, social style? So A, how long until they are able to have, well, first off, how big is a family unit? Second, when they do expand, like who gets kicked out and how far do they travel? How do they find a new home? Next, how old are they when they are able to have babies, and how many babies, and how long do the beavers live?
Wow, those are lots of questions. Good questions. So the beavers, they are only able to breed once a year. And a mating pair will have, you know, anywhere from 1 to up to 12 youngsters. They typically have about 4. The female has 4 teats. So we had 4 several years in Martinez. But the kids stay with their parents and get taught everything about being a beaver. They remain with them for up to 2 years before they go off to seek their fortune. And then they kind of have to find their own space and their own territory. They have to go at least 2 miles away, maybe as far as 50 miles away. And this is one of the things Martinez was concerned about. They were kind of worried, oh, my gosh, if we have beavers once, maybe we'll have this huge population and we won't know what to do with all those beavers. But we were really reassured to see that every year our yearlings, those are like teenage beavers, they would disperse. They go off and they kind of find their own space and start their own new lives.
And when they do that, do they usually travel up and downstream, or will they actually cross dry land? That would be pretty scary, it seems.
Yeah, and when a beaver is dispersing, when it's left its family behind, that's actually the most dangerous time in a beaver's life, because it doesn't have a safe place and it doesn't have family people to look out for it. But absolutely, beavers disperse over land. They can go quite a long distance over land. They actually use seawater to disperse. So like if they're on a river that there's no place to live, they will actually use the seawater to get to the next river where they might be able to find space. So beavers do a lot of foraging and a lot of looking around for a new place that is safe to be.
So sorry I keep putting off the urban stuff, but this is just so fascinating to me. So when they get to a new place, so they find they're either going over land or they're going through the ocean or however they go, and they get to a place and they think, this is where I want to live. Is the first thing they do, like, do they dig a big hole in the bank, or what do they do to protect themselves the first thing?
Well, it depends on where they are. I mean, beavers are very territory dependent. So if they're in a large river that won't work, then they will just build a hole in the bank, and that's perfectly all they need to survive. If they're in a small river that is essential to dam, they might start working and then kind of leave calling cards for other beavers in the area, like, I'm a single male looking for a female. I mean, beaver scent mounds are actually the equivalent of singles ads, really. They leave a lot of information about what is needed and what is missing.
And then when they form a pair bond, are they usually, do they mate for life, or do they make a new family a year later?
Well, beavers form pair bonds and that are permanent. So they mate for life. Now, there is some research that says that beavers will opportunistically have some additional matings in addition to the partner they keep for life, but they are, they stay with a family unit they chose. Our pair in Martinez, the female died and the dad actually remarried after a few years. So, we definitely got the whole soap opera in Martinez.
Okay. One last question before we go to urban beavers, which is, so how long do they live normally?
I would say in the wild, 12 to 15 years is a grand long life for a beaver.
Okay. So first off, where is Martinez? Second, are urban beavers a common thing? And then third, can you tell the story of these beavers from the beginning of at least your association with them?
Okay. Well, so Martinez is about 40 miles northeast of San Francisco. So it's a kind of a commute town to San Francisco, but it's also a very old town. So historically, it was the last home of John Muir, for example. And it's also the hometown of the first Shell refinery. So we've been around a long time. Now, you asked all your questions at once, and I forgot the middle one. What was the middle one?
Are urban beavers a
common thing?
A common
yes,
thing.
They are, actually. So beavers were pretty much wiped off the landscape in the 1800s. And for years and years, they didn't show up in much of California. But in the last 20 years, beavers have been sort of returning to their former habitats. And of course, they all look different. Martinez couldn't remember ever seeing a beaver in our creek, for example, but beavers have actually become much more common than they used to be. In fact, 5 years ago, we did a study on this, and we saw that 38 states reported issues of urban beavers in 2015. So if beavers have never been in your creek before, they're probably on their way.
Well, that's good, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, so now can you tell the story of the Martinez beavers?
Okay, so to tell that story, we have to go back to 2007. And what happened was that a male and female pair of beavers moved into the creek that flows right through Martinez, that flows right across Main Street. It happens to be about 8 blocks from my house. And I met a neighbor on the street who said to me, "My goodness, have you seen the beavers?" And I thought, well, that doesn't sound very realistic, but maybe I'll go check it out and see what's up. But I did not see the beavers right away, but I did see that they had built a dam, that they had chopped down some trees. And as I continued to watch, then I was really surprised to see that, boy howdy, there were beavers right in the middle of town. In those days, you could go to Starbucks, get your morning latte, stroll out onto the patio, and you could watch the beavers. It was pretty amazing. And since it wasn't anything that anyone in Martinez had seen before, people got really interested. You know, neighbors would meet each other on the bridges or in the parks to watch the beavers. You might go down and see your third grade teacher, or you'd see your butcher one day. It sort of was a community event to have this urban wildlife that was so unexpected.
So before you continue, that reminds me of something when I was a kid, that in third grade, whenever, one of the field trips we took, this is in the late 60s, one of the field trips we took was to a nearby farm where they showed us off the barn owls, and we saw the little, you know, owls will eat a mouse and then they'll regurgitate the fur. And
right.
We saw all those little pellets, and I still remember this. And the point is, did they have field trips from kids to go look at them?
Absolutely, absolutely. And involving the community from the very beginning was something that really moved this whole issue onto the forefront. Kids from, you know, kids did all kinds of field trips to the beaver dam. We'd have people contacting us from all over the Bay Area. They wanted to come up and see the beavers. And as this continued to get some publicity, the city also got concerned that the dam the beavers had built was going to cause flooding. And so the city announced, pretty surprisingly, that the beavers were going to be killed. Now, the way trapping law works in California is beavers cannot be relocated, so there wasn't any place for them to go safely. The only thing that could happen to get rid of the beavers was the final solution. And people did not like that idea. So they started talking, you know, to each other, to the media, and it turned into a bigger and bigger story. At one point, we were on all the local newspapers. We were on national news. We were even, a story that got on Brit Hume's Fox News national radio. So it was a pretty big deal. And I was happy about this attention because I thought that maybe all these eyeballs on the story would slow the city down and make them a little more cautious in what they decided to do.
So before we talk more about the controversy, that you said the California laws, they can't be relocated. And a couple of years ago, I interviewed Sherry Tippy, who is one of my heroes. And she relocates, quote, problem beavers, end quote, in Colorado from a city where they were going to be killed to the countryside. And can you tell me a little bit more about that law? Cause that really annoys me. And one more thing is I live in far northern California, Crescent City, and there's a stream right behind where I live that would be just perfect beaver habitat. And a fantasy I've had for the 20 years I've lived here is that, oh, if there's some poor beaver going to get killed, I could relocate it. But now thank you very much for destroying my fantasy.
Well, honestly, I think Sherry's great, and she's one of the very first people I called when we had that issue. But I will say that my personal preference is that people who have problems with beaver solve the problem, not get rid of the beaver.
Oh, I completely agree with you. Completely agree.
And ultimately, since the beaver population is kind of rebounding, if you move some beavers, the odds are that you are going to get, in this adequate habitat that you have, you're going to get new beavers coming back. Because basically what you're doing when you move them is you're putting a vacancy sign on the property. And some other disperser is going to find it.
Well, and another problem with relocation in general is that, and this doesn't matter whether we're talking about bears or anybody, is unless there is, like, okay, I know somebody who is involved in anteater relocation, giant anteater in South America, and there is plenty of prime habitat, and the only problem is that the giant anteaters themselves have been killed, poached, or whatever. So in that case, you can bring them in, but if you bring them in, like when they relocate a bear, quite often they just drop it in some other bear's habitat and it gets killed anyway. It really doesn't usually work. But okay, so having said this, let's move forward. How strong was the impulse to kill the beavers? Touch and go was this disagreement, or was it pretty easy or pretty hard to save them?
Well, I would say that one of the challenges is the way the beavers happened to move was right next to the largest property owner in all of Martinez. So the most powerful voice in all of Martinez, I would say. And so they wanted the beavers gone. And the city council is very used to listening to that powerful voice. So they were quite sure that the beavers were going to go. And it was unbelievable for them to even have to discuss the issue with all these, you know, ragtag citizens that showed up and said, we want to keep the beavers. That was just, it was an unheard of thing for us to object to, because, you know, nobody really had ever coexisted with beavers in an urban setting before in California. We were sort of the first. Nobody had installed a flow device in California before. We were really the first. So what we were asking to do was to ask the city to completely turn around their opinion, which was took a great deal of pressure and a great deal of faith on the city's part.
And you know, one of the things that I try to do with my work is to encourage people to defend what they love. And so can you talk about, I mean, because it's so easy for us to go, oh my gosh, I'm so sad because I love those beavers, but there's nothing I can do. So can you talk about what you and other people did to save them and sort of give pointers to somebody who may not have done this sort of thing?
Well, I can only give the pointers that I've picked up over the years and say that, you know, my background, not a biology background, not a wildlife background. This wasn't what I did for a living. I had a different hard job that took all my attention. And when I heard that the beavers were going to be killed, I thought, well, that seems like a really bad idea. I mean, I had been watching these beavers. I had watched them have kits the first summer. And when kits are little, they make this low whining sound that sounds like a child crying. It's really compelling. And I thought, gosh, do the people that want these beavers dead even know about that sound? And if I don't do something to stop them from dying, am I ever going to hear that sound again? So I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll work on this for a weekend. Maybe I'll work on it for a week. How long could it possibly take? Now that was 15 years ago. But I figured I would talk to people. I would use the skills that I had. I would use the contacts that I had. And, you know, just to give you an idea, 15 years ago, there were not any sources on the internet about how to coexist with beavers. There were 3 sites on the entire internet. So I had to contact all these people personally by phone and talk to them. That's why I called Sherry Tippy. That's why I called Mike Callahan. That's why I called Skip Lyle. They didn't have that information available any other way. And that really started a big education in my mind about all the value of beavers and the trickle-down benefits that beavers could bring.
And from the other side, what is their main argument? I knew somebody, and this was an acquaintance, and it annoyed me no end. An acquaintance in New England somewhere wrote to me one time and said, oh, there's some beavers and they're going to flood my sort of the back end of my property. It really pisses me off. So I'm going to call, you know, Massachusetts Fish and Game or something and have them come kill them. And
that's
something that unfortunately I think we hear. I mean, I've heard fairly often. Is that a fairly common response?
Yeah, that people are concerned that beavers are going to raise the property, raise the water on their property so that they lose part of their boundaries or they lose a retaining wall or they lose maybe access to their basement. People are also concerned that beavers are going to flood roads or block culverts or chew down prized trees. I mean, obviously, cities plant landscaping all along urban creeks, and they don't do it so beavers will eat it. They want those trees to stay in the ground and prevent erosion and all those kinds of things. And they're not happy when beavers make plans. Now, Martinez had a particular section of creek that had been for years and years just completely abandoned and not treated well. And it was the end of this huge flood restoration project. They restored this one section of creek to its natural qualities, right? They planted some trees. They left some bank exposed. It was very lovely. It was the result of 50 years of hard work by East Bay Regional Parks to even allow it to happen. And the ultimate result of their hard work was that beavers moved in and said, wow, this is great. This will do great. So it was really a compliment to our restoration, but the city obviously didn't take it as a compliment.
Okay, so move forward with the conflict. How did it move forward from there?
Okay, so the city has a plan to kill the beavers. People are upset about the plan. And more talking, more and more news. Everybody's picking up the phone, calling in the city every day. And so the city said, okay, we'll have a meeting to decide the fate of the beavers. And they pretty quickly decided this meeting couldn't happen in City Hall because there were too many people that wanted to be part of it. So they had to have it at the Performing Arts Theater at the high school. And that meeting took place in November of 2007. And 200 people showed up for that meeting. They came from uptown, downtown, and out of town. And they said, one after the other, we do not want you to kill these beavers. Find another way. The Humane Society was there. The Sierra Club was there. The superintendent of schools said he would pay to have students plant trees for beavers. It was an unbelievable meeting. And I have come to describe it as a cross between the last 5 minutes of It's a Wonderful Life and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. It was that good. So kind of at the end of that huge, massive meeting, the city council, and it was about 4 hours long, the city council said, okay, we'll think about this. We'll appoint a subcommittee to study the issue further. And they let me be on that subcommittee. And we had 90 days to outline the pros and cons of living with beaver in an urban setting. And that was the beginning of the next stage of the beavers, which is, you know, we were able to hire Skip Lyle, bring him in from Vermont, and have him put a flow device in the creek so that the water would continue to do what it needed to do in the creek to keep the flooding from happening. And once that flow device was installed, that pretty much totally solved our problem. Now, the people in Martinez, I will say the city council might not even have believed it would work. They kind of just agreed to do it because they wanted to show that they had tried everything they could and they figured it wouldn't work and then they'd be able to bring in the second solution. But it did work. And for 10 years, this controlled the level of the dam in town. And that really made all the difference. Now, I will say that even though the city decided to do this, they agreed to do it, they actually never voted to allow the beavers to live. They never voted to say, okay, well, we'll cooperate with beavers. We'll give beavers a free pass in our town. And I figured that it would be better to keep the pressure on them. So I started Worth the Dam to continue to advocate for them and educate people about them. And we held the first year, we held the first beaver festival because I thought that it would be easier to protect the beavers if we threw a party for them and everyone was invited. And so we've had now 13 festivals and really do a lot of education for other cities about how and why to live with this important animal. It made a huge difference in our creek. Because of those dams the beavers built at one time, we had as many as 5. We saw new fish in the creek. We were able to photograph new birds. We knew, document new mink and otter and wood duck and hooded merganser, all things that were never seen before in Alhambra Creek. And we're visible right from Main Street in the middle of town.
And as time has gone on, has the city council switched over yet to like the beavers?
I wouldn't say they ever switched, but they definitely learned to switch their vocalizing. They definitely learned which side to pitch for, and we were actually added to the congressional record by our congressman. So it was really such a success story in so many ways that at this point the city, if we still had beavers, the city wouldn't be able to do anything about it. But our beavers, about 3-4 years ago, they decided to leave their hometown and took off. So right now we're in between beavers, but I definitely think we learned a lot from them, and they benefited our creek and our community.
So do you have any idea where any of their babies ended up dispersing to?
I do, actually. I think we have some of their young in Napa. Some of them, you know, went into like the other side of the Carquinez Strait. We have some beavers right now in Fairfield. We have some in Rodeo. So, you know, beavers kind of, they don't write, they don't call, but we get to hear stories from other communities who contact us, and we can kind of infer that they might be ours.
And is this pretty typical that of beaver natural history, that when a family either moves on or dies out of old age or something, that their home might be empty for a couple years before somebody else moves in?
Absolutely, yes. And you know what I will say, it definitely depends on what the population of beavers at the moment is. You know, there might be some place that is really crowded, and so beavers need to go to a new area to kind of find territory, but then all of a sudden space opens up, and so that space, that new territory might not be as popular during that time.
So the fact that that they haven't been there for a couple of years is not particularly worrisome to you?
We've had beaver, what I call beaver drive-bys. You know, we've had beavers come in and chew trees, things like that. So I know they're in the area. No, it's not worrisome. I know that they can, I mean, this particular creek, which is both tidal and fresh, has a particular set of demands that maybe beavers, not all beavers, are willing to put up with. Yeah.
Right. Okay, so let's change the subject for a minute. There is an event that is happening very soon, and can you talk about that event?
Right. So one of the things that I really want to happen is for California as a state to get more informed about why beavers matter on the landscape. You know, we're far behind, say, Colorado or Oregon or Washington or Utah even. I wanted for us to be able to have a conversation that would talk about how important beavers are to salmon, how important beavers are for climate, for adapting to climate change, how important beavers are. Now there's new research that beavers are really important for fire resilience and recovering after fire. And so I really got talking with a colleague of mine at Sonoma State, and we are working to put on the first California Beaver Summit. That's happening on April 7th and 9th. And we have we're going to have experts from all over, including experts that are local to California, but experts like Michael Pollack from NOAA in Washington, and Joe Wheaton from Utah, kind of to talk about beavers doing what they do and how to coexist with them, and also how to adapt their more difficult behaviors to a place that we can coexist with them. And the difference they make for birds and for amphibians and for salmonids, and really and the ways that they can benefit California.
So I want to hear more about the summit, but I also want to hear more about something you said a moment ago about how recent research suggests that they are beneficial for fire resilience and recovery. And that seems to make sense to me, but I don't understand why. Can you explain why?
Yeah. so a lot of this research comes out of Emily Fairfax's dissertation, and she is right now working at Cal Channel Islands. She's a professor there, and she's actually going to be one of our keynote speakers at the summit. What she found was that looking at the habitat of some really large fires, both in Idaho, California, and Oregon, you could see that the plant recovery in habitats that had beaver was very different than the species recovery in areas that did not. And, you know, one of the things, and this has been really discussed in lots of different venues. Just recently, it was in the National Geographic, and it's going to be in the California forest discussion coming up. But you can really see not only that it makes a real difference for recovery, but it also, as we're having beaver ponds saturate the soil and keep water on the landscape, that it really makes a refuge for all the wildlife during the fire to be able to have a place to hang out and stay safe, but also probably provides a break for some of that fire as well.
And it seems to me that with saturating the ground like they do, it seems to me that beavers would do would provide an extra layer of drought protection.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. You know, back in 2012, when FEMA was bailing out states at a great rate, that because of drought damage, you could just look at the map of the states that were the least tolerant of beaver, and you could see that there was almost a one-to-one correspondence, that places that didn't tolerate beaver on the landscape were the ones that were hardest hit by drought. And I certainly, you know, beaver ponds are shown to you're storing water not just above the soil line, but actually below. You're recharging the aquifer. You're actually making, I think one study showed 9 times more water on the landscape than equivalent areas without beaver ponds.
Wow. Okay, let's go back to the summit. And before we move on to more details, how do people either, is this online, or do people actually show up?
Right. So, one of the things that we, did with this summit is this is going to be a virtual summit because we had no idea where things would be. We wanted to have it this year, and we thought also this is a good place for California to start because California is not, we're not at the head of the class yet. So, I don't think we'd get, 100 fish and game experts to come to a 2-day beaver summit in person. But we have over 500 people registered right now for this virtual conference, and over 100 of them are CDFW. So I'm really happy about that. A lot of professionals, a lot of agency folks interested in the subject. hungry for this subject.
Can members of the general public attend too?
Yes. So you would go to the website, which is the California Beaver Summit, and sign up. And we're very interested not only for professionals to learn these skills and this information, but also for, you know, I'm not a professional. I was just a layperson like anyone else. And learning this made a huge difference in my life and in the lives of some lucky beavers.
And it's the 7th and 9th. And is it all day on those 2 days, or what are the hours?
No, it's 4 hours. It's 1 to 5.
Pacific.
And let me just say, April 7th, we actually chose this date, oddly. It happens to be an International Beaver Day.
Oh, that's great.
You probably didn't know there was such a thing, but there is. And it's a perfect way to celebrate.
And it says on the website itself that you're excited to have students. So can you talk to teachers for just a moment here? And
right.
How would teachers/students participate in this?
Yeah, well, we're very excited to have the next generation of naturalists be aware of this information. And what we wish is that if students are participating or registering through a class, if it would be possible for a teacher to register for that class and then the students to watch that teacher's, screen, rather than have, all 30 kids sign up for the conference, because our bandwidth has its limits.
And is this, is there a fee associated with registering?
There is not.
Okay, so this is free in addition to everything else.
We're the cheap date in town, and we're the date that could really make a difference for whether California can survive its next fire season or drought season, or be able to fish for salmon another year.
And is this do people have to register pre, or can they just show up at the time?
They have to register pre.
Okay. Okay, so now that we got that out of the way, can you go back to a little bit about the event itself?
The event itself is going to be 2 days, and I really am excited about those 2 days. I think the idea is, I will say that one little caveat about beavers, particularly in California, is that because California was settled so late that there was some controversy about whether beavers were even native in California. And we worked with an author who's going to be presenting the first day about documenting beaver nativity in California, that we kind of were able to publish a paper in the journal, publish a series of papers in the Journal of Fish and Game a couple of years back that sort of addressed that and pretty much put that issue to rest. And that really started with a archaeologist from the Bureau of Land Management who found a paleo beaver dam in the Eastern Sierras and had carbon tested the wood from that dam, and found that the oldest parts of that dam had been continuously rebuilt from 530 AD and all the way up until the fur trade. So that kind of gave us the platform to reexamine the literature and the information. And anyway, the first thing we're going to talk about is that beavers belong here in the first day. And so I would say the first day of the conference is really beaver essentials. So beavers and salmon, beavers and nativity, beavers and amphibians and birds, and managing difficult behaviors on your property by using flow devices or restoration tools. That's Beavers 101 is the first day. And the second day is really beaver dynamics. So how they affect other species and also how to work with the human species so that you can allow beavers to do the work they need to do on the landscape.
So is your experience generally that people, people, apart from that big landowner, do people generally love beavers when they, is this?
I would not say that. Beavers are a hard sell. You know, even people who are sympathetic to wildlife, they still like their, you know, cherry tree not to be chopped down. They still like their basements with all their photographs not to flood. I mean, there are a lot of things that beavers do that are not convenient. And I will say that in Martinez, you know, we solved the beaver problem, and that took about 3 hours. But the human problem, we're still working on it 15 years later. So I think managing human expectations and human decision making, that's the real challenge.
So I'll tell you something. Go ahead.
We're smarter than beavers.
Not sure about that.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something that really annoys me is that I wrote a book on zoos many years ago, and at the time there were some grizzly bear cubs who were going to be put in the San Francisco Zoo because their mother had been killed in Montana. And they killed the mother because she ate like 50 pounds of corn and in somebody's barn. And it's like, okay, you're living in grizzly territory and you should just be so happy that you actually saw a grizzly bear, and 50 pounds of corn is not very much. This isn't like it, you know, it killed your kid or something. And 50 pounds of corn is nothing. So for me at least, and maybe I'm different than a lot of people, but for me it's like, instead of getting mad at the beavers, I would be so happy. It's like a generation ago, people couldn't see beavers in Martinez. And what a thrill. And like you said, I love the part where you said that, that you could hear the kits. And, you know, I've seen beavers in the wild some, but I've never heard a kit.
Right. I mean, so, it is a precious thing to be able to see a beaver in the wild, but I also think it's really valuable to be realistic about the challenges that come with beavers. Because being realistic means it gives you the opportunity to be hopeful.
Right.
And I just think, you know, if you talk to someone and you say beavers are great and beavers are going to change the world, well, they are, but they're also going to change your plans sometimes. And there has to be some realistic solutions to be able to deal with that.
Right. Right. Okay. Well, we have like 2 minutes left, and can you give us one last, little bit about the conference, and then after that, one last little bit about how much you like beavers.
Well, I will say that for me, the most exciting thing about the conference originally when we put it together and we're getting people signed up, we didn't have much response from some of the large organizations that most interact with beaver in California, see the Fish and Wildlife, and I was really frustrated about that. But I have been much more encouraged that so many people have signed up for this and are so interested. And you know, even though CDFW isn't giving them the day off or paying them to watch this conference, I'm really touched that so many people who do this work want to learn more about how and why beavers matter. And I would say for myself, one thing about beavers that really made a difference is that they actually created a community, not only in Martinez, which they created a community for all of us watching them and engaging with each other and having to cooperate with people we didn't know very well. I mean, sometimes when you'd go see the Beavers, you'd end up talking to the homeless because they lived right alongside them. And it definitely created a crossover of community in Martinez. But I would also say that Beavers, because their value on the landscape is so rarely understood, it's only just beginning to get more public. They actually have created a real community in at large. So that I know people now from all over the country, from all over the world, really, that I would not have known more because of this, because of this community Beavers have created. And the fact that it really makes a difference in someone's life when they understand the value a beaver brings and also the anxiety with which beaver are greeted in so many places.
Well, thank you so much for all of that. And before we sign off, I just want to say it's C-A-B-E-A-V-E-R summit.org. C-A, California, C-A, beaversummit.org. And the other website for people to look at is martinezbeavers.org at WordPress. martinezbeavers.org. Is there anything else you want to share in that way?
No, I think that those are wonderful for you to share. And certainly there is a great deal of information about our work in Martinez available on that website. But I also work to cover every beaver story that I can across the country to kind of learn about how other people are doing this work.
Well, thank you so much for all that great work, and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Heidi Perryman. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.